This is The Energy Exchange, conversations about how energy connects to the economy, national security, and sustainability, helping you to understand a changing world. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jan Mueller. On today's show, Saudi America? Is America really the new Saudi Arabia of oil? Or has a recent surge in U.S. production obscured the risks still posed by America's profound dependence on oil? With a dramatic drop in prices sending shockwaves throughout the oil industry and dampening the early euphoria about a shale oil revolution, do we need to rethink what a recent U.S. oil boom really means for America's energy security? What factors have fundamentally changed, and what realities remain essentially the same? On today's show, we'll examine these and other critical questions about the outlook for oil and implications for America's future. And with us to help address these questions, we have three outstanding guests that I'm very pleased to have on the show today. John Staub is the team lead for exploration and production analysis with the Energy Information Administration, the U.S. Department of Energy. Tad Patzik is the director of the Upstream Petroleum Engineering Research Center at the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology in Saudi Arabia, and previously a professor and chair of the Department of Petroleum and Geosystems Engineering at the University of Texas. And Art Berman is a consulting petroleum geologist with Labyrinth Services and a frequent commenter on oil and gas issues, a contributor to Forbes and many other publications. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today. If we could, let's get started. Let's start with an overview about how the United States and North America is really different than Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. And Tad, given your unique perspective of having spent a lot of time and done a lot of work in the United States and now stationed in Saudi Arabia, how are things looking from where you are?
Well, they surely look differently than how they looked, let's say, a year and a half ago when I was in Austin. You gain a new perspective. So let me talk briefly about how Saudi Arabia is different from the United States. Saudi Arabia is essentially different from the United States in that Saudi Arabia is a very large oil producer and a very large oil exporter, and it actually does not import pretty much anything in terms of petroleum products and petroleum. Saudi Arabia has been producing plus minus 10 million barrels of oil per day, oil and lease condensate. I want to be very cautious here. And it consumes about 3 million barrels of oil per day. That right now in 2015. Its consumption has been growing on average about 20% per year in recent years. It has some signs of slowing down, but it's still a very high rate of growth. In Saudi Arabia, most of electricity is in fact produced by using oil-powered power stations, and a rough estimate of how much oil is used to generate about 300 billion kilowatt hours of electricity in Saudi Arabia, well, that estimate is about 1.5 million barrels of oil per day. So that's a fixed cost. Also, Saudi Arabia uses up about 3 cubic kilometers of water per year, out of which I estimate 1.8 cubic kilometer comes from water desalination, and water desalination is powered by oil. So again, that's a fixed cost for Saudi Arabia. Now, there is loose talk in the U.S. about, you know, the United States being the next Saudi Arabia. That is absolutely a false statement. While U.S. has produced 9.5 million barrels of oil and lease condensate per day in 2015, U.S. also imported 7.3 million barrels of oil per day from various sources, most importantly from Canada. Imports from Saudi Arabia are not very big in the U.S. In fact, they're just a small fraction of imports. So by volume, crude oil imports were 78% of domestic crude oil production. And we must not forget this because the numbers I just mentioned are obfuscated in various ways. For example, by saying there is availability of crude oil and production and petroleum products, which was about 19 million barrels per day in 2015. So that's a very high number. Out of those 19.4 million barrels per day of petroleum and products, imports were 9.4 million barrels per day, which means that about 2.1 million barrels of products were imported. At the same time, the U.S. exported 4.4 million barrels of products per day and a small volume of oil, about 500,000 barrels per day. So I threw a lot of numbers, and probably most listeners will forget them immediately. So let me recap. The United States imports 78% of its own domestic crude oil and lease condensate production. Saudi Arabia produces 100% and then exports 65% of that production. That's a fundamental and inescapable difference, which is now obfuscated and confused in the United States. Having said that, Saudi Arabia will be consuming more and more oil internally because of the growing population, which means that unless strict controls are taken internally and nuclear power is introduced as a source of electricity, Saudi Arabia will be able to export less and less as time goes on. The last point I would like to make is, which becomes clear if you do a certain type of analysis of production, which I will not name after King Hubbard, but essentially these are Gaussians that result from production from many wells or many fields. You will see that the recent increase of production in the U.S. Is actually defined by a cycle, by a Hubbard curve or a Gaussian, which is very steep and very narrow. That means that the rate went up almost vertically, but it will come down almost vertically unless there is incredible and continued influx of money, resources, and so that drilling can be continued at the current rate, which I doubt it will be, but I let others speak to that. So that's pretty much my opening remark.
Well, Tad, thanks very much, and that's a great overview. So the first question is supply is one side of the equation, but demand is the other. And even though we technically export certain products, we are a big consumer, so we're really not in the same position as Saudi Arabia. Then the big question becomes but
we are also a big importer. We must not forget that. You cannot be a swing producer if you import so much oil. What are you going to swing? What you've imported?
Understood. And I'm trying to reiterate your point, but then the thing that people are still hopeful about is that at least the share of our own domestic consumption that we've been able to produce ourselves has gone up dramatically. And then the big question becomes, how long can we sustain that? Especially given what's going on with capital investment and prices and a pretty uncertain future. John Staub, what is EIA thinking about? You guys come out with the annual energy outlook every year. You'll be coming out with a new one in June or so, if I'm not mistaken. And you'll be incorporating some of these new changes. But what do we know from your existing the analysis that you have out there, as far as what's going on with U.S. oil production and in particular shale?
Thank you, Jan. One thing to note, a different way to look at U.S. production is to first think about U.S. consumption. So in 2015, the U.S. was consuming about 19 million barrels a day of total liquids. So this includes crude oil, refined products, biofuels, et cetera. And of that volume, the U.S. was producing 9.3 million barrels a day. And this year, in April of 2016, we reached almost 9.7 million barrels a day of production. So a significant portion of U.S. production of total consumption was coming from domestic production of liquids. When you add on refinery gain and biofuels, our net imports of total liquids in 2015 was actually about 22% of total consumption. So we actually are at a very low point in terms of imports. But when you look at the absolute numbers, that hides what's actually happening in the U.S. oil industry or oil market, is that the U.S. is becoming more interdependent with the global market. We are importing volumes of crude oil that we actually convert into refined products and are exporting more of those refined products. And now with the removal of restrictions on crude oil exports, we're having some exports of volumes that are, there's an economic benefit for trading of those products. But we see with these low prices, a slowdown in crude oil production in the U.S. From April of 2015, high of 9.7 million barrels a day. We've declined down to, sorry, I'm forgetting exactly what the number is.
It's about 9.1 million a day, John.
Thank you, Art. So, and we're declining roughly at about 80,000 to 100,000 barrels a day, month over month at this point from our analysis. In our short-term outlook, we have production declining down to about 8.2 million barrels a day in the second half of 2017. And then we have prices beginning to recover, and that starts bringing production back up slowly.
That's the story to date. And what's going to come of this shakeup, if you will, in the industry? Low prices, they're coming back up from below 30 barrels, dollars a barrel to around 40 today. Art, what's, from your perspective down there in Texas, what's been going on in the oil patch with all this, you know, low price and projects put on hold or canceled and financing rethought?
It's a fascinating situation, Jan, and one that I don't think anybody would have or can predict, certainly not me. I am frankly stunned by the amount of capital that has flown into E&P in the United States, mostly tight oil production so far in 2016. If you would have asked me in December, I would have said, boy, you know, I think the funding is going to be severely restricted with all of the distress, with potential bankruptcies and problems with the high-yield corporate bond markets and et cetera. But the reality is that mostly through share offerings, something like $10 billion has come into the aid of U.S. exploration and production companies so far this year, which far exceeds last year at this time, which was higher than any year, I think, subsequent to 2010, right after the recovery in oil prices after the financial crisis. So from my perspective down here in Texas, the industry is in considerable disarray, and yet there seems to be an almost limitless access to capital from around the world to continue to to fund whatever operations are going on. So, on the one hand, I read a lot of opinions saying that if oil prices get back maybe just a bit higher than they are right now, say to $45 a barrel, that all of these companies are going to go right back to producing great guns again as they did about a year ago when we had an oil price increase up to about $60 per barrel. At the same time, talking with people in the field, listening to discussions by the likes of the head of Schlumberger and Halliburton, that seems less likely than it was a year ago. I mean, rigs have been laid down, crews have been let go. A lot of these service companies are really running on skeletal kinds of support. And so I think the likelihood of just going back to drilling as if nothing ever happened is improbable. A lot of the money that's flowing in right now, I think, is being used to pay down debt and to pay for overhead, not so much going to new drilling. So I think the EIA forecast for basically losing another 900,000 barrels of oil crude oil between now and September or so of 2016 is quite probable and realistic, and it's going to be an important component of where prices can go. And I'll just finish this this comment with the observation, though, that one of the things we learned from the price rally back in March through June of 2015, when, as I said, prices got up to $60 a barrel, is that it appears that increase of only about $15 a barrel had a profound effect on demand. And part of what cratered that price rally, and there are many factors, but part of it is that apparently there was actual demand destruction from that relative, well, percentage-wise, it was a very high percentage, but, $15 a barrel increase. And so when I hear people speculate about the possibility of oil prices going back to $60 or $70, I don't think anybody at this moment has the ability, to say what's going to happen. But that very recent analog tells me that demand is very much range bound within certain prices, and that demand will go up at very low prices, and it will also be capped, or at least that's what the analogy tells me. So in summary, the oil business is in a bigger mess than certainly the public perception that there's always. We're always finding ways to drive costs down to zero. And, of course, production has been resilient. I don't think anybody can dispute that. But I think the reality of it is that things are looking really quite grim. More and more layoffs. And we will undoubtedly get into a discussion of what true costs and the cost of technology actually is. But I'm not nearly as optimistic, and that's why I think the EIA forecast is quite reasonable, that we're going to see a lot more decline in coming months.
I do very much want to get into the question of costs and technology, but I think what's given all the disarray, as you describe it, people are losing money, but many of us learned in Econ 101, there's the point which you may be losing money, but it's not necessarily the same point at which you close your doors. So we've seen rigs count decline, and we've seen people losing jobs, and people are certainly losing money. But it's been the decline in actual production has been softer than some of that activity would suggest. And is it because a much smaller part of the capacity of the industry is producing most of the oil? Is that important to understand?
Well, again, it's a very difficult question, Jan. I would just refer to my own work, things that I have calculated myself. So I'll tell you this. There's obviously a cause and effect between the price of oil and the number of rigs and the number of wells drilled, and that those numbers have subsided. The production in all major shales, gas shales and oil shales, has turned around, peaked, and is now declining. And in fact, as I wrote in my blog, in my last two posts, all of the major shales in the US have seen a peak of production. And again, by using a statistical model that essentially sums up weekly correlated or uncorrelated variables, which is well production, and there are thousands and tens of thousands of wells per play, so that's a very good sample. There's a very robust inference that can be made out of this, which is, you know, the global production rate and the ultimate recovery, regardless of the fancy economics and fine-tuning of the analysis at the end. And that picture shows me that the production will keep on declining now very rapidly in the foreseeable future unless we reinstate a massive drilling and fracking program in the United States. But having said that, the herd is not limited to the United States or is not limited to Texas. Everybody's hurting. Saudi Arabia is hurting. Saudi Aramco is hurting, even though their oil production costs are very, very low compared to most of the American production costs. So the cost-cutting measures are everywhere. The service companies are essentially scalped and driven to skeletal crews everywhere. And nothing will come back so very quickly around the world, but especially in the United States, where the relative effort to bring the production up is much, much, much higher than, let's say, in Saudi Arabia.
I guess, Jan, I've seen a number of reports about what it costs to produce oil, and there's general agreement in terms of the distribution of costs for the large producers around the world. There was, for example, a report that CNN Money carried of analysis done by Rystad Energy, and they said that the average cost of operational expenses for oil production in the U.S. was about $15 a barrel. And, you know, of the top 20 producers in the world, the top 17 producers were under $15. So from a short-term perspective, the cost of producing oil is still significantly below what the traded Brent or WTI prices are.
Right. But back to Econ 101, and it's about the marginal cost and price. So I think the question, you know, EIA data shows or projections show they wouldn't disagree with Tad's characterization of that we may be at or near a peak, but the decline much more gradual, still in the 8-9 million barrels a day range, you know, well into the future. And that, though, depends on, maybe it might be useful, John, to talk a little bit about how EIA constructs its projections, because it is contingent on demand and price that might support that supply. It's not, it doesn't say that these millions of barrels will come out of the ground because they're there, that the economy and the industry, based on a return on investment, that will bring them forth. And then we can talk about, you know, given all that investment, whether or not this is, you know, what's possible. But could you talk through that a little bit?
Sure, I'd be happy to. We do analysis of the global market in terms of resources and distributions of the cost of producing resources around the world and demand factors. So looking at economic growth, policy deployment, trends in development across emerging markets. And from that analysis, we produce our three oil price cases for the annual energy outlook. These are meant to be long-term market equilibrium scenarios. In our reference case, we have oil prices, for example, in the AEO 2015, rising to around $80 by 2021, and then kind of steadily increasing to about $140 by 2040 in real terms. Those prices then are an input into the modeling system that's used to produce the long-term outlook. And the resources within the U.S. are responding to those prices. Similarly, on the demand side, the various sectors of energy consumption in the U.S. are responding to the market prices that they're seeing. And so then that's producing the balances that we have for oil production and for all the other types of oil energy production in the annual energy outlook.
So if it's not just prices, it makes sense to break even. You know, you can make some money at a certain price. It's also that it's going to bring forth that investment. So, Art, I'm wondering what, you know, you've done a lot of work looking at how some of the financing for this is all works. So the EIA, the reference case is a range of 70 to $140 dollars a barrel. You know, you've got a lower price scenario below that, and then you've got something that's even higher than that. No one is here to predict oil prices, and if we could do that, we'd all be doing something else right now. But to just understand that what really has to happen for the industry to maintain the level of investment that Tad is cautioning about.
There's a few things that are important to understand. And the first is that low prices are not all bad. Service costs are radically lower right now than they've been really any time in the last 10 or 20 years in real dollar terms. And an awful lot of the much touted efficiency gains and cost savings that we hear about so regularly are really just, you know, reduced cost of oil field services, including drilling costs. And just to give you a real life example, I'm in the oil business. I'm not a pundit and I'm not a journalist. I'm not an analyst. I'm a petroleum geologist, and I drill wells, and my clients drill wells. And we just finished drilling two wells that when we originally got bids for the drilling rigs, and they were here in Texas, we got bids of around $28,000 a day. These are top shelf, high horsepower diesel rigs, and those estimates came in the latter part of 2014. By the time we signed the contracts in the spring of 2015, those costs had come down to about $16,500 per day. So there's been a tremendous reduction in the cost of doing business, and that, you know, the high cost of doing business when oil prices were $100 was crippling, I mean, killing an awful lot of the major oil producers. So that's something that doesn't get talked about a lot. There is a kind of a weird upside to low oil prices. And the flip side of that, or at least the corollary to that, is that much is made of technology and drilling efficiency. And I'm certainly not going to dispute that goes on, but I think it's a factor of diminishing returns that you don't continue to increase drilling productivity and efficiency at 15% forever. I mean, I think a lot of that is kind of worked out of the system. So that's I think that's an important piece of this. The bigger factor, though, and John is correct, I think, in saying that $12 or $15 per barrel of oil or barrel oil equivalent is roughly the variable operating costs that these companies have. But I think when we read about break-even prices, and there's so much of that that it must confuse the heck out of almost anyone who tries to understand it, that there really is a there's an awful lot of costs that, like drilling the wells, the major capital expenditures, that you just can't factor out and you can't ignore from that. And so, I don't want to get into a specific discussion, but just so listeners are clear, in the work that I have done and have collaborated with others on, the idea that anybody, any company, that is, can break even at anything less than about $50 a barrel of oil is just way beyond any kind of reality check that we can do. So so we talk about 12 to 15 to just pay operating expenses, but of course to actually justify the full expenditure, we need more than three times that much. And if you look at the financial statements of these companies, and most of them have now reported for full year 2015. I mean, it's just a disaster. It's an absolute disaster. You know, the debt ratios, the debt to cash from operation ratios of most of these companies that I follow, both in the tight oil and shale gas sphere. I mean, the average for these companies is well above the threshold for banks to technically be able to call the loans because they're too risky. You know, the kind of capital expenditure to cash flow ratios on average are well over 2-to-1. I mean, this is a very precarious industry that we're in. And so then the question is, well, why does money keep flowing to it? And I think it's pretty straightforward. And that is that we live in a post-2008 financial crisis world where interest rates have been artificially kept at pretty near zero. And those with money just demand a better yield than they can possibly get in conventional passive investments, which is to say treasury bonds and savings accounts and certificates of deposit. And while I'm sure most of these investors would love to find a better place to put their money than U.S. exploration and production, they just can't turn away from the yields that they're getting on corporate bonds and preferred shares, and getting 7 or 8%. And so the question is, you know, at what point is there a negative payback? And you know, that will ultimately be, if it comes, and I don't know that it will, you know, that will be the point of crisis. Now, I was on a panel up at the University of Texas a few weeks ago for their UT Energy Week. And the other three members of the panel were energy economists and hedge fund managers and CFOs of E&P companies. And those guys, not me, they were all in full agreement that if only 30% of U.S. oil companies go bankrupt in 2016, that would be good news. So I'll leave my comments there.
Okay, well, I think you all have set the stage and lay out the landscape pretty well. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we can dig into the details of what will have to happen to keep the oil boom that the United States has benefited from these last several years going. And, you know, what could change some of the projections and scenarios that we're seeing. We'll be right back. And we're back talking with John Staub of the U.S. Department of Energy's Energy Information Administration, Tad Patzik with the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology in Saudi Arabia, and Art Berman with Labyrinth Consulting Services, a petroleum geologist based in Houston. And before the break, we were talking about all the upheaval that's been going on in the U.S. and global oil industry. And those are obviously important to a lot of people, a lot of dollars invested. But from a broader public interest question is what the longer term trend might look like once we get back to normal, what normal might look like, and where we might be in terms of supply, cost, price. Again, we're not trying to compete in our forecast, in our predictions, but just understand the factors that are going to shape the future. And one of which is that Saudi Arabia, despite the fact that we're currently producing comparable volumes of oil, seems to have a lot more oil in the ground and of a conventional sort. I mean, there's not any shale production happening in Saudi Arabia currently. And that's a big question, whether or not our shale development experience can be exported elsewhere. But John, what does EIA think about in terms of looking longer term beyond these ups and downs in price and investment and financing and everything that Art talked about earlier?
Well, certainly, you know, the Saudi Arabia reserve numbers are 260-some billion barrels that are frequently discussed. The thing to note is that those are more akin to 2P reserves. Whereas the U.S. reserves, which are around 33 billion barrels, are 1P reserves, which require a higher level of certainty in the investment and the infrastructure that will be used to produce those reserves. So it's not an apples to apples discussion when we talk about reserves in those regards. If you look at other resources that the U.S. has in terms of unproved resources, there's roughly an additional 225 billion barrels of those unproved resources. So there's a significant volume of resources in the U.S. compared to the annual production, which is more on the order of about 2.5 billion barrels currently. I think it's important to, as you were saying, Jan, that we're in the midst of some, you know, market fluctuations right now, and there's a fair amount of uncertainty in where prices are going. But when we look at the longer term, the annual growth in demand is globally for liquids, so it includes crude oil and natural gas plant liquids and biofuels, that's roughly 1 to 1.2 million barrels a day. And we see demand by 2040 globally growing to about 120 million barrels, give or take, depending upon price scenarios and other policy type assumptions.
Demand globally growing, but I think EIA still has domestic consumption and demand for oil pretty much staying about where it is. And at the same time, our economy growing. So is that a rough?
Correct. Yeah. We stay in the 18 to 19 million barrel a day demand level for liquids.
So we never become energy independent under any scenario, really, or even, to use a better, a more accurate term, energy self-sufficient. We may be exporting, we may be more interconnected with the global market, and we may be exporting more finished products. But in terms of volumes, is that a fair assessment that we're this, what we started talking about is how, you know, our consumption is so high and we're not really going to be exporting in a net sense?
Right. In our reference case, we continue to be a net importer. We do have a high oil and gas resource and technology case. And in that case, we do have, forget exactly what the numbers are in terms of net imports, but they are actually net exporting in that situation.
Net imports are 2.7 billion barrels per year in 2015. Okay, I'm thinking hard how to convey to the listeners the mind-boggling complexity of oil supply, oil demand around the world, the state of the global economy, the climate change, the political changes which are occurring now everywhere in the US, in Europe, rise of nationalism and virulent tendencies in so many countries. And just to try to make sense out of this is almost impossible. In addition, the system which we are operating right now has absolutely unbelievable complexity, which I don't think anybody can grasp anymore, including people like me who have worked in the industry for 30 years, have been reservoir engineers, researchers in academia, and have been working with the industry for so many years, and have been doing analysis of production and mechanisms of production for decades. And so, you know, we can talk about economics, we can talk about many things, but let me just give you a simple example that I find actually instructive. So in early 2011, I analyzed production from the Barnett Shale based on the data from Texas Railroad Commission through October of 2010. And I made a prediction using my usual approach. And that prediction was whatever, 26, the ultimate production of about 26 TCF, trillion of standard cubic feet, for the current development in the Barnett. And in the subsequent 4 years, you know, many people discarded or disregarded that prediction. And because everybody knew that the Barnett Shale has to produce more with the improvement of technology and more people drilling wells and everything kind of going up and up. And so I revisited the Barnett just 2 months ago, and to my surprise, I found out that prediction I made in very early of 2011, and I showed it to the advisory board of the College of Engineering at the University of Texas in Austin, and was published, that prediction was spot on. In the end, when everything was said and done and the situation in the world changed, you know, several times, the Barnett shell produced what I thought it would produce, and it was much less than other people thought. And so I would say that I would warn anyone, including myself, because, you know, I doubt my own results just as much as I doubt everybody else's results, from predicting the future as one of ever-increasing supply and demand. My own take on the future is that, in fact, even though the population of the Earth is increasing dramatically, the demand will actually stagnate sooner rather than later, and so will the supply. So, of oil, I think people will go to other resources. I think people will be using a lot more photovoltaics and wind, which will be playing an increasing auxiliary role in supplying energy. I think in many countries there will be an increase of electrification by using nuclear energy, as bad as it sounds to many people. But I would warn that right now, when I'm sitting here in the Middle East, I'm watching what's happening around me in Asia, in Africa, in the Middle East, that the global economy and the global system is incredibly fragile. And it takes just one major upheaval to dismantle many of the assumptions we have had and we've been taking for granted. So I would like to issue a little bit of caution about us issuing longer term prediction, other than the future will be certainly different than what you think it will be, and that climate change and the deterioration of global economy will be two big variables or wild cards in this equation.
I think, though, when companies are making these long-term investments, they can't avoid thinking about what's going to happen 25 years from now. And so we need to, and that's part of EIA's mandate, is to think about the long term and think about how the economics of the global market function. And from our analysis, the resources are much larger than people often think. It's one of these things where it's easier to study the things you know because there's more data related to them. But as we've found with the shales, there's often a lot of opportunity there in a place where there is not a lot of data. For example, I think you were saying that in your analysis, the Barnett produces 26 trillion cubic feet over the life of that play
in the current cycle with the current generation of wells, however many permits, about 20,000, there is a potential to increase the Barnett shale production, and that's because it's very unique in all American shales that it has a system of conjugate natural fractures which can be open during hydrofracturing. And in fact, its productivity is higher than the rate of decline of Barnett wells is lower than in most other shales.
Right, and we have about 52 trillion cubic feet being produced from the Barnett from when it began producing in 1990 through 2040. We build in technology changes over time too, of about 1% per year.
Well, so let me give another example. I just revisited the North Sea production in Norway, which is an almost picture-perfect analysis of summing up uncorrelated variables to give a Gaussian, which is the North Sea production in Norway. And I've looked at the developments in Norway after 2007, over the last 8 years. And there was a very considerable investment, of course, over the last 8 years. And those investments, wonderful as they have been, yielded marginal improvements, but they were, you know, barely able to slow down the rate of decline. So I guess what I'm trying to say, without sounding too cautious or too pessimistic, because I don't want to give that impression, that with the technology of which I'm aware, and you know, I have Norwegian friends who in Statoil, and some of them will be visiting me here next week, with the beautiful organization, beautiful know-how, deep technical knowledge, wonderful technology, Statoil was able to produce about 1.4 plus 2.5 billion barrels of oil more, which is very respectable. But the fundamental cycle produced 25.5 billion barrels. And so we have increased production by doing many, many things to different projects. But those increases are, you know, let's say 3 out of 25 or 9 out of 100 or 12 out of 100. 12% increase, great. But it's not, never will be 50% or more over the lifetime of the project.
So, Tad, you know, you noted how complex all these interactions are, and your cautions about too much faith in assumptions about demand and growth. But if I could just focus on one thing about what you're saying, especially when you started with your, about the Barnett or the North Sea, or really anywhere else, is that these applications of technology may be changing the shape of the production and the timing, but overall, you know, it moves, maybe it moves consumption and production up, but it doesn't get you necessarily get you more resource at the end. And so maybe we should be thinking about how to make these things last longer, as opposed to how quickly we can get them out of the ground. And I would invite everyone's comments on that, but I'd like to know if that's a, I don't know, a vaguely fair assessment.
In the United States, we seem to be rushing to to produce our natural resources as quickly as humanly possible, regardless of what kinds of economic returns we might get for our investors, and certainly with very little thought, I believe, to what benefits there are for the society in general. And so we are currently, we've lifted the crude oil export ban after 40 years. And, you know, taking the example of the North Sea, for instance, I mean, here the United Kingdom was, a great exporter of oil and natural gas for many, many years. And today they find themselves in the unfortunate position of having to pay whatever premium is required to supply their basic needs. The United States has just started exporting liquefied natural gas in February. First cargoes left Cheniere's facilities in Louisiana. And yet, you know, we have a natural gas forecast from EIA that says we should be moving into a supply deficit of natural gas later on this year. Now, a supply deficit doesn't mean that we're out of gas, but, you know, these are the kinds of things that I wonder about, where, you know, we're currently producing tremendous volumes of both crude oil and natural gas into price environments in which nobody can make any money. I think that's I'll be happy to back that statement up. But just as a stalking horse, let's just say that at these $1.75 per MCF gas, and roughly $30 or so less at the wellhead for crude oil, I mean, everybody's losing money, and so we're producing incredible volumes and we're exporting volumes into a market that doesn't return even our basic investments. And so where does the public end up on all this, assuming that they even care?
Art, that's actually a very good point. I've thought about it a lot, and I'm thinking about it even more. So if you are in a kingdom, the kingdom of Saudi Arabia, as I am, it's much easier to have long-range planning and coordination of production, facility build-up, drilling programs and what have you, and research. In fact, Saudi Aramco right now in Dhahran has the largest and probably the strongest research center in the oil industry around the world. That ability to plan, to coordinate, to keep production level, as Saudi Arabia has for decades, is in fact absolutely unachievable in the private equity market driven by private people, many, many companies, each one optimizing their own profits, while the overall good of the country is generally forgotten. In fact, you know, it was John von Neumann in 45 who published a book on game theory, where he proved mathematically that whenever there's two or more players in a game, the overall optimization of some one target function that would satisfy all players is impossible. That is, you know, you cannot, and even if in the case of a single company, I'll give a simple example. If you want to maximize your profit and minimize risks to the environment or risks of loss of life at the same time, that is actually an impossible task. And mathematically, it's inconsistent. And so we make those mental jumps and arrive at judgment that what's good for company A is in fact must be good for the country. And it isn't, in fact, not by a long stretch. And the example of Great Britain under Margaret Thatcher, where Great Britain was exporting natural gas and oil when it both cost almost nothing because she was such a strong believer in free market. And she was ousted right at the time when both prices went up. And I think it was in 2012, I have in my blog, Great Britain found itself in a position where the reserves of natural gas to run heating in homes in March of 2012, I believe, was 3 days away from exhaustion, because Great Britain right now is importing most of its natural gas. And so it's very easy to turn from a position of a major exporter to become, in a matter of years, a major importer, depending on the whims of the market and the suppliers. So again, I would issue this warning that this is a big game in which not everybody will come out unscathed.
And the United States actually had that experience of going rapidly from an exporter to an importer back around the 1970s. Sure. And we were on a long, slow decline before the shale boom began. So I guess, John Staub, you know, EIA does not make policy, but you do analyze scenarios. And I'm wondering this idea of whether it's production increases in the short term, what it means for the long term, and this issue of, you know, investments of technology and money, you know, whether if there's a either a point of diminishing returns, or maybe we need to, you know, apply that technology in a measured way as opposed to an all at once way for, and, you know, you can at least compare the alternatives of different approaches.
Right. We're certainly not, EIA is not a policy organization. We do analysis of the implications of policy on the energy market. I think back to 2003 when natural gas prices were upwards of $13 per million BTU, and now we're talking about prices under $2 per million BTU. And the question for the consumer is, which is a better environment to be using energy or expending money on energy? We're always going to have market fluctuations in the long term. That those will occur, and that it's part of how the market sends signals and balances changes in consumption and production of resources. It's just part of the market.
And how about the question about technology and costs? I mean, technology in some ways can bring costs down, but in some ways it doesn't, and costs have gone down because the price has gone down. So it's sort of a dynamic situation. But, you know, how does that fit into your how does technology and costs I mean, you talked about where average cost is now, but where does EIA think costs are going, or at least what are different scenarios for, and what's the interplay of technology and cost?
Right. So we just last week released a report that we commissioned looking at the upstream costs, both the costs of drilling and completing wells, and then also some information about the broader cost of producing oil and gas. And costs were essentially bid up leading up into 2012 as the shale, tight oil and shale gas really ramped up, partly driven to more complex and deeper and longer wells and completion techniques, but partly driven by just the expansion of interest in using that equipment to develop resources and lock in leases. Since 2012 through 2015, costs across kind of five key regions in the U.S., so like the Bakken, the Eagle Ford, the Marcellus, parts of the Permian, costs fell between 25% and 30% from 2012 to 2015. Some of that was due to the price drop, but some of it was due to better and more efficient use of equipment and technology. And so we've looked at how kind of technology improvement happens over time, and from kind of a very aggregate level, if you look at proved plus unproved resources in the U.S. From 1990 through 2015, generally have been increasing at about 3% per year. And from 2005 through 2015, that growth rate, annual average growth rate, is more on the order of 5 to 6%. So there's a lot of improvement that's happening, partly because of where the market prices are, and that creates incentives to develop new technologies, but also borrowing technologies from other industries, whether it's control technologies from cell phone technologies for directional drilling, or computing power that allows for improved seismic studies, or better types of alloys that are able to handle high pressures and temperatures. It's an ongoing process, and where there's an economic incentive to make profits, we see improvements in technology.
Well, I think there's obviously been huge benefits to the application of this technology, whether it was new technology or technology that's been around for a while that finally got cost effective to apply. But if we could, I think we should take another short break. And in the final segment, we can talk about this issue of where technology and costs fits in the broader economy. And if there is been incredible benefits from all this activity, but there are limits. And is there, can we continue to increase? Can we continue to tread water and sustain the levels that we've been seeing for a long time? Or, you know, are we ultimately going to have to deal with figuring out, what to do when things start going back downhill? We'll be right back. And we're back again talking with Tad Patzik of the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology in Saudi Arabia, Art Berman with Labyrinth Technical Services in Houston, and John Staub with the Energy Information Administration with the U.S. Department of Energy. And before our second break, we were getting into how technology has done amazing things in general, but in the energy world and in oil and gas in particular. But it's not necessarily a magic cure-all. This stuff does cost money, and this is still geology where it's getting more difficult. There's less high-quality resources to go after. At the same time, in our last podcast, none other than Scott Tinker, also of the University of Texas and the state Texas geologist, and some of his colleagues in this movie called Switch, talked about just basically how great oil and gas have been in terms of an energy source and a source of a driver of economic activity. So even though this stuff is getting harder, all things considered, given what it does for us, that it's beneficial to produce and we'll continue to produce it when there's demand. But what's going on in the global economy, a lot of question marks. So John Staub, if you would, you know, what is economic benefits of all this stuff is very much part of your model. I mean, it produces, I'll stop there, but there is obviously your whole model is based on an economic demand for this great stuff we call oil.
Right. I mean, as Scott and Steve in your previous podcast discussed, the density of oil and from an energy density standpoint, it allows for very efficient fueling of transportation options. And so, because we don't use oil for just using oil, or we don't produce oil just to produce oil. We produce oil and gas for heating our homes, cooling them in the summertime, transportation, keeping food, you know, safe to eat. And while, you know, we're not finding more large reservoirs like guar, there are, you know, many resources that we're discovering how to produce at still a very competitive price relative to other energy options. And we continue to spend on the order of 4 to 5% of our GDP on these types of energy sources for, I think, transportation. So it's, you know, continues to be valuable and relatively affordable compared to other options.
And Art and Tad, in your long careers, you know, you've seen how, you know, this stuff is getting, you know, we've moved from conventional to unconventional and all this technology. You know, what is your perspective on what those changes mean for the broader society and the global economy?
Well, I think John makes a very good point, I won't dispute it that, you know, as long as we're able to produce crude oil and natural gas at a profit, that we're going to continue and we should continue to do it. But you know, I want to create some context that so much of what we hear is, you know, how the wonders of the miracles of technology keep making all this stuff cost less. And, you know, I think the impression that a lot of the audiences that I speak to have is that, you know, it's almost free because of the wonders of technology. So I was speaking with the board of directors of a municipal power company in the East Coast last week, and I went through a calculation with them. So, you know, most of their gas comes from the Marcellus Shale, and it's, you know, in my view, by far the best shale gas play, certainly that's ever been discovered from a geological standpoint in terms of, you know, estimated ultimate per well recoveries, commercial break-even kinds of considerations. But here's the reality, that with all of the improvements in efficiency and technology, we're still stuck with the reality that each well completed cost $7.5 million. And every month for the last 6 months, 180 new wells about have been added. So you do the simple arithmetic there. That means that we're spending $1.3 billion a month on completing new wells in the Marcellus Shale. Now, it doesn't take very many months for, you know, that to become, well, $1.3 billion is a heck of a lot of money, and maybe leave it there. So, you know, yeah, it's, you know, we're getting the costs down, everything keeps getting better, but we're spending $1.3 billion on one play every month to add production, and production is not increasing at the rate that it once was. In fact, we're making, you know, 13 or 14 BCF a day from Pennsylvania Marcellus, and that's huge. But, you know, that rate of growth is declining. So, I mean, I think that's the context that oil companies around the world have increased their capital expenditures over the last decade tremendously over the decade before, and yet you know, the incremental improvement or increase in oil production and gas production has not been so great on a global basis. So, you know, on the one hand, I want to acknowledge and, you know, and even celebrate the our ability to continue to find and produce more and more oil and meet the needs of the world, which is, as an industry, that's one of our responsibilities. At the same time, I think Tad's point is well taken, and that is that the overall efficiency of doing that may not, you know, we may be reaching a point of diminishing returns.
Well, actually, both John and Art made very important and very good arguments, and I agree with both. In fact, I would like to add that oil and natural gas are mathematically equal to blood of all societies on the planet. You can actually show it that the consumption of oil and gas per capita, per day or per year, is akin to basal rate of metabolism in all mammals, you know, for all countries. So let's say the Democratic Republic of Congo or Burundi are the microshrew, and Qatar and Abu Dhabi are the bluefin whales. But the scaling of the standard of living with consumption of oil and natural gas is just like the standard, you know, the scaling of how a body functions with the blood flow. From this, it follows that all societies on the planet would suffer greatly if that flow of petroleum blood and natural gas blood were diminished. And so that's kind of the concern that I have, is that we have to make a certain preparations for the day when these flows will be diminished, especially internationally. Individual countries may keep up their internal production and satisfying their internal needs, but the overall amount of petroleum around the world may actually stagnate or even decline in the next decade or so. And so that's probably the biggest point I would like to make to the audience, that oil is so valuable, let's not waste it. And that's also very difficult for individual people to implement in their private lives. So that's pretty much my take on this issue.
I would caution, though, in terms of you know, thinking about how demand is going to change over the long term, because just in the last year, information in terms of research on semi-autonomous vehicles and autonomous vehicles suggests that there may be opportunities to significantly reduce consumption in the not very distant future.
Sure, but at the same time, the number of cars or automobiles around the world, I think, is reaching or has exceeded 1.5 billion cars. And that alone, since petroleum supplies most of all transportation fuels to speak of around the globe, that results in an increase of demand, which is continuing rather linearly with time, regardless of all other uses of petroleum around the world. So yes, I don't think we'll exhaust the subject during this program, but hopefully, you know, the listeners have maybe a glimpse of the scale of this industry, which is probably the largest industry on the planet, of its importance to the well-being of all developing and developed societies, and of the consequences that will accrue if there is underinvestment in new petroleum projects or maintaining production from the existing petroleum projects. And to Art's point, and to risk that point, the Norwegian analysts, there has been a very rapid decrease of investment from, let's say, $600 billion in 2014 around the world to something like, what, 250, I may be off, but, in the latter part of 2015 and now, and that lack of investment will be translated into fewer projects getting started and in fewer projects being maintained in the next few years. So that's something that we also need to be cognizant of.
So, John, EIA has, for most fuels, including renewables, you know, pretty much either a maintaining or a slight increase for some in some sectors, you know, through to 2014. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, even if we were able to achieve that and with a lot of investment in dollars, I mean, it's possible that the economic benefits of all that may diminish over time. They'll still be significant and we'll still have a society and economy. But I guess in terms of the growth, the GDP projections forward, I mean, is there a way of even considering that in your model? And I don't know if it has to, you have to look at the globe versus just what's going on in the United States. But, you know, where does the, what kind of economic questions do you guys ask yourselves when you're basically making those longer term economic growth projections?
So our models have macroeconomic feedback built into them. And the reality is that the amount that we spend on energy is quite a small share of our macroeconomic activity in the U.S. And while the numbers that Art was talking about just a few minutes ago sound large, the U.S. economy, our GDP in 2015, was roughly over $18 trillion. So the individual wells on a, you know, sounds expensive, and you add up a lot of wells, that sounds expensive, but it's actually quite small. So right now what the market is telling producers is that there has been too much investment and oil and gas production needs to slow down to raise prices, and it will possibly create a period of time of underinvestment that will push prices higher than they would have been if there had been a more closely matched level of investment to global growth. And the market works fairly well, but it's not perfect in terms of how it judges how quickly demand is growing or slowing in any given time period.
I think this issue of energy and the economy, not just oil. I mean, we already had one show on oil and the global economy, and it seems that there needs to be a lot more discussion about it. Obviously, it's been important in our economic history. There are researchers that point to what you say, John, about the percentage of oil that accounts for GDP. At the same time, if the capital stock, that this is a point that Stephen Brown of the University of Nevada made, the capital stock of the world's economy is also highly dependent on energy, especially oil. And so the productivity of that capital stock is a question. So it's an ongoing question that we hope to shed some light on with this show. And we will bring more people with the energy expertise that you guys bring, but also economics and other perspectives about what's going on in the United States and around the world. But we're close to the end of our time, so I would just like to invite all of you to make some closing remarks. And let's start with Art.
Well, thanks, Jan. And I agree, this has been a fascinating discussion with some really different perspectives. So where I stand on assessing moving forward in the United States, particularly with energy and with oil and gas in particular, is that we constantly hear how things are getting better and companies are getting more flexible and adjusting to this low-cost environment. At the same time, it seems that we're really eager to believe that we're moving back toward normal. Things are, we're going to get back to oil and gas prices where companies can actually make some money. And I don't want to be pessimistic about it, but I think it's important that people who are not deeply involved in the industry or in the analysis of the industry understand that this is a moment of crisis in oil and gas production, both in the United States and around the world. And while it may be true that the amount of of GDP that's invested in energy is a relatively small or manageable of total U.S. or total global GDP. Sitting here in Texas today, I can assure you from the number of the adjacent to my building as one measure that there has been a market effect on at least the Texas economy in terms of the reduction in spending. And that spills over into all of the correlative or collateral economies that you drive down into South Texas and the Eagle Ford area or over to the Permian Basin, and people that run hotels and car washes and gas stations and restaurants, they're all feeling the result of diminished investment as well. So energy is a core aspect of the economy. It may be the core aspect of the economy. And I think it's a mistake to understate the level of emergency that currently exists in energy exploration and production. And I think it's important to understand what returning to normal may mean. So I've described how the U.S. and global energy business is in a situation of considerable distress right now, and we hear that we may be have entered a period of rising oil prices that will get us somewhat closer to normal. I want to say that I think it's unlikely that those oil prices will return anywhere close to the very high $100 a barrel oil prices that we experienced consistently from late 2010 until near the end of 2014. And that probably that's a very good thing for the world economy and for consumers in general, that it may be nice to talk about getting back to $100 oil for those of us in the business, but that had some rather negative effects on consumers and on the global economy. So no one knows where we're going. Hopefully prices will stabilize somewhere in the middle between where they have been, where they were, so that companies can go back to making a little bit of money and rehiring people that they've been forced to let go. At the same time, what we're going through right now will be a long-term and rather structural adjustment.
Thanks very much, Art. Tad Patzick, you're in Saudi Arabia. The Saudi economy, as well as the Saudi government budget, is obviously in a little bit of turmoil with these low oil prices. But what's your perspective on where energy fits in the economy?
Well, energy, actually, it's not energy. It's power. It's energy per unit time. One of the big misnomers that we use as mental shortcuts is that we say energy. We really talk about power. If we were talking about energy, it would be the same thing to drive a little scooter and a BMW 700, but it's not, because the latter has more power. So power that is generated by petroleum, natural gas around the world, literally powers the global economy. That global economy builds on top of that base, the foundation, incredibly complex structures which are called hedge funds and stock markets and mutual insurance and hedging and betting and what have you. And the illusion that all of these activities create is that they are so very important. And they may be very important. In fact, in many cases, they provide the lubricant which actually makes the economy move and flow smoothly. But without the power at the base of that huge infrastructure, the infrastructure will simply fall apart. So as a petroleum engineer and as somebody who works on better technology to be applied in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Middle East and in the world, and working day and night, in fact, I want everybody to understand how important petroleum is to the well-being of the world and how dangerous it is to have an attitude that suddenly the renewables will supplant and displace both oil and natural gas from the economies of most countries. I think that responsible people need to focus on the role of petroleum, natural gas, and the power they bring to the global economy, how to use that benefit, that incredible benefit that accrues from them, to develop better sources of renewable energy, which are inevitably subsidized by the infrastructure that is based on crude oil and natural gas. So in a way, most of us are like fish, you know, who live in water, but we don't know or we forget that our noses are wet. So we can talk all we want about how irrelevant water is for us, but we're still fish. And without water, we die. And so on that happy note, I would like to end. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tad. John Staub, you have the last word.
I think it's important to realize or remember that the oil and natural gas industry is a cyclical business, and the low prices that we're seeing currently are part of that cycle, and they will go back up again, and they'll go back down again, and continue cycles at various intervals. It's also important to remember that the reason why we produce oil and gas is because of the value that it brings to our lives. And we can't talk about oil and gas without talking about the resources that are in the ground, the technology that lets us reach those resources and extract them, and the marketplace value that those resources provide to us. We can't talk about oil and gas without talking about all three of those pieces. Thank you.
John, I think that's well said, and I think in general we agree with all that, and there's finer points, and I think it was a really rich discussion today. And I would just like to point out that the Energy Information Administration produces an amazing wealth of information, of which the work of ourselves as well as the other guests on the show, you know, would not be possible without it. So thanks very much for taking time today. You were going to say something,
Can I say something?
Go ahead.
Yes, I want to thank EIA. And thank you again for providing all the data. And, you know, especially now being abroad and looking in other countries and the quality of reporting on energy issues. The United States, I just told my students this the other day, the United States has an unparalleled quality of providing information about energy around the world. And no other country, perhaps but a few, you know, Norway, Germany, come even close. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I agree with that. I find myself very often assailed with questions from my audience about, don't you think there's manipulation going on with the information, and, you know, we can't trust these forecasts from EIA and et cetera. And what I always tell them is, look, you know, a forecast is just a forecast, and it's going to be wrong no matter what. But I'm sure glad somebody does it. And I completely agree with Tad that, you know, so much of the work that I do and therefore the living I earn is based on the high quality of information from EIA. So, you know, don't want this to turn into a mutual admiration society, but I really do appreciate the work you guys do.
Okay. Thank you, Tad and Art and Jan. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise.
All right.
So we've been talking with John Staub, the team lead for exploration and production analysis at the Energy Information Administration at the U.S. Department of Energy, and Tad Patzek, the director of the Upstream Petroleum Engineering Research Center at the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, and also previously a professor with the Department of Petroleum and Geosystems Engineering at the University of Texas, and Art Berman, a consulting petroleum geologist with Labyrinth Services. And you'll find Art's comments on oil and gas issues and their connection to the Wire Society and Forbes and many other publications. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us today on The Energy Exchange.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
For more information on this show and other shows, you can find us online at energyx.org and on Facebook and Twitter at TheEnergyX. Thanks very much.